Today's episode is made possible by Affinity Solutions. Unlock your business's potential with actionable insights into consumer spending, powered by Affinity Solutions. With exclusive insights from over 140 million cards, Affinity Solutions showcases consumer purchase behavior with unprecedented clarity. Seize the opportunity to reshape your strategy with accuracy, execute with precision, and measure with confidence. Affinity Solutions equips you to outperform in today's competitive landscape. Step into the future of analytics with Affinity Solutions today. Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers weekly listen, the last one of the year, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Affinity Solutions. This is the Friday show. That feels like it's going to regret having Paul on. At some point throughout the episode, you'll realize why. I'm not a mean person. You'll realize why.
I don't know. Soon.
Right, Paul? I can just see.
Yeah, I mean, the only part I would disagree with, you said at some point during the episode, and because we're on video, I think that point is going to be right now, so I hope you all bear with me. I just have to do a little wardrobe change. Also, I'm just going to move to another room, so just bear with me a second. There we go.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. A background, too?
Paul, that was awesome. So seamless.
Oh, just moving to another room, as I said.
It's too much.
I don't know what you mean about background. Much,
Paul, do you want to explain why you're doing this to me specifically?
Yeah, I'll explain it to you. I think our listeners know that this is the week that we celebrate the first anniversary of Argentina winning the FIFA Men's World Cup. But Marcus, because you and I have not talked about this very much and I haven't emailed you
once a week
every day to remind you of this.
Yeah.
I just want to make it, you know, clear to you as well for your benefit.
So is this the first time Argentina won?
It is the third time. The third time. That's why when I send Marcus these reminders, I usually put 3 stars, one for each.
You wait till victory. England finally win, Paul. I'm going to come to your home.
Has England never won?
I'll look forward to that. England
basically
has,
never yet.
back before any of us were born.
Yeah.
30, even me.
30 years ago.
Okay, I wish. Double that. I'm your host, Marcus Johnson. In today's show, is this the very beginning of how Amazon ends?
Well, and the whole thing about these players is gamification. And so while Amazon doesn't have that, it certainly has that treasure hunt, sort of like you never know what you're going to get.
Welcome to the ad-free internet.
The article talks about the growing number of people who pay for online news content, but it doesn't mention that a lot of this comes from publishers basically not giving people a choice.
Should we be pairing shopping with streaming?
This is just, you know, one of the many, many tests that Walmart has been producing over a series of years just to sort of figure out what that mix might look like that does work.
What can we expect from X at this year's Super Bowl? ChatGPT signs a huge deal with a giant publisher. And what are the most visited tourist attractions in the whole world? Join me for this episode. We have 3 people. Let's meet them. We start with our Vice President of Content, heads up our retail desk. It's Susie David Canyon.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hello, hello. Based in New York. We're also joined by someone else based in New York, someone on that very retail desk, Senior Analyst Blake Droesch.
Pleasure to be here, Marcus. Do we have to like smile and stuff when we talk now that
no, you're
we're on
fine.
Video?
Okay,
good.
Don't pretend.
I wasn't
don't,
planning.
Don't
on
pretend.
It.
Just be your usual surly self.
That I heard an uptick in your answer there, actually.
In the tone?
Yeah.
Yeah, you could fake the tone, but the smile is just it's just so much harder.
Okay, thank you. And finally, we're joined by football great. Used to play for now plays for Inter Miami. I used to play in Spain for some teams and got Argentina to their third World Cup last year. Born in Rosario, Argentina, it's Lionel Messi.
Muchas gracias. Es un placer estar con ustedes.
Also known as Paul Werner, one of our other vice presidents of content. Yes, Paul Werner, of course, based just above New York. Okay, let's get to the episode.
I love that t-shirt. It looks really
please
good.
Please don't.
Thank you.
Please don't.
Thank you. I will say, though, that I'm going to
finally
put on my branded sweatshirt over this
anything
again.
For a drape on.
Because Susie and I discovered this morning, both of us being on Zoom and having not coordinated at all, we're
thing
both wearing our
the same swag.
Here we go.
Can you see mine?
Intelligence hoodie.
Blake, are you also wearing your England shirt under your hoodie? Like I am. Or did you,
you know, it's at the cleaners.
Okay.
Yeah.
That means in the trash. What do we have in store for you? We have a story of the week. We're going to talk about Amazon. Is this the beginning of the end? Seems a bit harsh, but we'll talk about it. We then move to our game of the week. We end with some dinner party data. Some random trivia stuff, but let's start, of course, with the story of the week. Is this the very beginning of how Amazon ends? An open embrace of cheap foreign products has helped Amazon take over the world. It also might guarantee Amazon's eventual obsolescence, writes Amanda Mull of The Atlantic. She thinks that over time, Amazon has transformed itself into something that functions more like a global flea market than a traditional retail store, saying folks search the site looking for products that are good enough and scanning multiple reviews before making this low-stakes gamble of a purchase, as she calls it. The success of this system is what has made the retailer into the everything store. It might also be what leads to the eventual end of Amazon's dominance. And so what she's talking about here, folks, what she's talking about for several years running, she says, American media have been puzzling over the rise of a new crop of ultra-cheap international retailers like Shein and Temu, who ship most of their stuff to Western buyers from Chinese suppliers. And she thinks that these mega retailers are taking off in the US by charming young shoppers in the early days of the pandemic and continuing to, with clothing so inexpensive, it's made H&M look like a splurge. So Amazon sells lots of stuff, and now you've got these giant Chinese retailers kind of muscling in on their territory, and Amazon's kind of changed somewhat given how much it's grown. Susie, I'll start with you. What do you think? Is it too hyperbolic to say that this is the very beginning of how Amazon ends?
I actually do think it's hyperbolic in that Amazon is not going to die a slow death or a quick death because of the Chinese players. However, I do think that Amazon is trying to protect itself by doing new things, like trying to be a little bit cooler, by intensifying its fashion assortment. What will cause it to start losing more market share more quickly is the lack of stores. They just recently closed the Style stores, and that was a super bust. They've been closing lots of the different sort of iterations of physical footprint. The only thing they have left is grocery, and even that's not going super well. So yes, I think Amazon is so far ahead of everybody else that it's not these little players that are going to make a difference, but I think they're just smart and they're getting ahead.
So Blake, let me throw it to you, because you're also on the retail desk. They're definitely, you know, they're not as close, nearly as close as Amazon, as big as Amazon. And similar to cable, you know, going down and down, but there's still 40% odd folks who still have cable, even though it has been declining for, you know, decade and a half plus. So they're not as big, but they are as big as some of the other smaller retailers like Target, especially in the US. So Amazon's made way more than Shein and Temu. So they made $220 billion last year in revenue from online sales. But that you've got Shein and Temu who are making about $20 billion a piece. That's about the same amount as Target made online. And these retailers also like pretty brand new. So given that growth trajectory, do you see this being as more of a threat to Amazon than perhaps it looks on the surface?
No, not really. I mean, I tend to agree with Susie. I think that, you know, the one thing that this article sort of misses is that the allure of Amazon isn't necessarily about the products as much as it's about the customer experience that Amazon offers. Temu and Shein are basically replicating one aspect of Amazon, which is, you know, selling cheap offshore products of dubious quality. But as the article points out, that's often an aspect of Amazon that a lot of customers don't really like. The other side of Amazon is that all of the major CPG brands sell on the platform, on the marketplace. So you can get the same high quality products on Amazon that you can get anywhere else in any major retailer, online or offline. But if you're a Prime member, you can order them more seamlessly and get them faster than any other online retailer. And that's really what's keeping Amazon dominant, particularly as people are buying more of their, you know, essential goods and everyday household items online. And that's a space where, you know, Temu and Shein aren't even vying for, let alone, you know, putting a dent in Amazon's e-commerce dominance.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the whole thing about these players is gamification. And so while Amazon doesn't have that, it certainly has that treasure hunt, sort of like you never know what you're going to get. You know, all those sponsored ads make it so cluttered, the experience online, that you are treasure hunting, quote unquote, to find what you're looking for and to feel good about the deal. The other thing that Amazon has that the others don't is the quick shipping, right? Here we're about consumerism and quick gratification and constant stimulus. And so part of the reason why these brands are so cheap, these like no-name brands are so cheap, it's because it takes weeks to get the merchandise, right? You've already bought it and you've forgotten about it and then it appears. Whereas on Amazon, you get it right away. And so I think these are not the folks that are going to take Amazon down.
Paul, coming to you for a second. So there's a Bloomberg piece cited in this article saying that the rise of these retailers, Temu, Shein, meant piles of Chinese junk topped Christmas lists for US consumers. So that was a quote from the article. But Miss Mull from The Atlantic pointing out that Americans, saying that's probably a bit of an unfair statement, but saying Americans have been snapping up inexpensive imported stuff, Chinese and otherwise, for decades, since the shelves of Walmart, Target, Costco, among others, are full of cheap foreign products. This is the reality of American shopping, whether or not buyers realize it. Do you think, you know, eventually these names, Shein, Temu, can become kind of household names similar to Amazon? Really, the difference is that people have been shopping on Amazon for a long time and they just kind of trust the brand more.
I think part of me wants to look at this whole thing and say, okay, Amazon, you've created this monster and now it's coming to eat you. But I think the reality is much more along the lines of what Susie and Blake described. Amazon has a lot of different levers. It can pull a lot of different businesses. It has AWS. It has its media business, content. It has Twitch. It's just, you know, it has grocery. I mean, it just has so many areas that it operates in. And this is just a sliver of it. It's really just a sliver of their e-commerce business. And Amazon could very easily use this as an opportunity, for example, to pivot to more of a quality focus instead of like emphasizing some of the aspects that they've emphasized. So in other words, come to Amazon and you're going to get trustworthiness, reliability, quality products, accountability on the part of the merchants. A lot of things that I think Temu and Shein are not in a position to offer right now, and it would probably take them a lot more to scale that up than it would take Amazon to make a pivot along those lines.
And that, I don't know which author said good enough, but like no brand should ever operate on good enough. Like there is nothing sustainable about a good enough brand image. So, you know, not only is it bad quality, and so people will get tired of that, it's not coming quickly enough, but like Blake said, it's also not branded merchandise. At some point, especially as there are more and more, you know, food recalls and other sort of product recalls, people are going to start to pay more attention to what they're buying.
I think Miss Mo was saying that that's how consumers, I'm curious what to know what you think, Susie, that's how they look at Amazon now, is that they're not expecting the most perfect high quality things in the world. They know that they're sacrificing, you know, high quality, amazing high quality guaranteed for an insane hoard of products to sift through.
You know, I think it depends on how you shop. Like I shop by brand. And so I shop by item by brand.
Point.
So I don't see those things, right? And then I also shop for Amazon Prime. So like if I'm going to buy something on Amazon, it's because I want to get it as quickly as possible. Otherwise, I have other retailers I go to. So maybe for some people, but I can't imagine that it's for the majority. And I don't know what the household income is for Prime members, the average, but they were saying for some of these Chinese players, it's $40,000 household income averages. And so, I mean, like that is definitely, they're going for down and dirty, cheap kind of merchandise, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, what, 15, 20 below the US average.
Yeah, but they don't have a choice. These are people who have to really stretch their dollar. So it's not good or bad. It's just they don't have another option necessarily.
Mm-hmm. All right, folks, that's where we'll leave the story of the week. Time now for the game of the week. Today's game, what's the point? I read out four stories and Susie, Blake and Paul give us the main takeaway of the story. Okay answers get 1 point, good answers get 2. And answers to give you the same feeling as when you get home and transition to sweatpants.
Good one.
Yeah. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you've been wearing sweatpants for too long.
I'm a jeans in the house kind of guy.
Really?
Yeah.
Same, same.
Really?
Same.
You come home from taking the subway
I'm
and
the
you
same,
don't
actually.
Change your pants?
Yeah.
No one said didn't change them, just change into a different pair of jeans,
okay.
Right, Blake?
That's fair.
Paul puts on his Argentina
Paul's butler.
Football
you said it, not me. Yeah.
Full kit.
I have my butler bring me a robe and then
yeah.
a selection
ironed
of
jeans.
Of pressed
yeah.
jeans.
A selection
yep.
of Argentina yep. kits. I like to think you're yep. wearing the full kit, Paul. Cleats as well.
I am.
You know what I think is going to change for next year? You're going to keep score properly.
What do you mean properly? It's always been properly, okay?
No. We all know it's not.
Only when you lose is it apparently not properly. I'll also leave you with the sweatpants feelings. That gives you 3 points, 20 seconds to answer before you hear the bell. Don't run long. Blake, excuse me. Whoever has most points wins gets the last word. Let's play before Blake can make a cheeky comment.
I've been pretty quick lately.
You have. I meant Susie.
I'm always
quick. I just say Susie every week, so I want to make it feel a bit better. Round one, let's start with... Paul's up first. Welcome to the ad-free internet, The Economist writes, noting that as the rich pay to banish commercials, advertisers hunt for their attention elsewhere. It points out Meta offers folks in Europe ad-free paid versions of Facebook and Instagram. X, also known as Twitter, just launched an ad-free option, and TikTok and Snapchat are both testing some as well. And Brian Weezer of Madison and Wall says, quote, "We are in a world where it will be increasingly possible to avoid ads," close quote. But Paul, is the internet actually becoming more ad-free?
I have a lot of issues with this article. Oh, so on the point of Meta and TikTok and X experimenting with ad-free subscriptions, yes, they're doing that, but we don't know yet if those are going to stick around, if they're effective. The article talks about the growing number of people who pay for online news content, but it doesn't mention that a lot of this comes from publishers basically not giving people a choice. It also doesn't mention whether the subscription revenue from these people is additive. It talks about Spotify, 40% of their users pay for the ad-free tier, but doesn't mention that this percentage has actually been dropping steadily since 2019. And it also, in my opinion, overlooks the fact that in the streaming video space, which generates more ad revenue than news and audio combined, all these ad-supported tiers and platforms are gaining a lot of ground. And frankly, I think it takes some of Brian Weezer's research a little bit out of context. So a lot of problems with this article, which I know is trying to be provocative with its headline. So they get points for that.
Susie.
So I do think that there could be a world where the internet will have less ads, but I don't know that we're there. And I think we're masking it, right? So it's not that there won't be ads. It's just that you're going to pay to not have an ad experience. And if you choose to do that, you're still going to get the influencers that are doing unboxing and sort of other more covert advertising styles, which I think is probably worse, right? If advertisers just had a little bit less annoying ads that were properly targeting me, I wouldn't need to skip them and I would be happy to see them.
Blake.
Yeah, I agree with what everyone said. I mean, this idea that the internet is becoming ad-free is really just a cloak for the fact that it's shifting like it always does. And I think all of those points that were made, you know, resonate. Some social users might pay extra for an ad-free experience, but the majority is still going to opt to use the free service with ads. As Paul mentioned, you know, the percentage of connected TV users has been growing for years, and it's making up a larger and larger percentage of digital video viewers. And then, you know, Susie's point about influencer marketing and earned media on social media, there's still going to be ways for brands to reach users who decide to use the free service without ads. But the ecosystem is really just evolving. And as media on the internet continues to become more and more fragmented, people are going to be using more and more different services, whether it's more social networks or more AVOD streaming platforms. And they're just going to be more willing to watch ads to access more content rather than they're going to stick to a single platform and pay for it to be ad-free.
I like this line from The Economist. The existence of ad-free options does not guarantee take-up. Round two. Let's start with Susie, pairing shopping with streaming. Two related stories here. One, Disney is exploring adding gaming and shopping to its streaming service, Disney Plus. More details are expected at this year's Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas. And the second story is Walmart planning to launch its first shoppable video series, a holiday-themed romantic comedy called Add to Heart. Play on Add to Cart. Roku, TikTok, and YouTube is where it will be. This is according to an article from senior retail analyst Zach Stambor. He notes the 23-part series weaves the retailer and 330 shoppable products throughout its plot. But Susie, are shopping and streaming a good pairing?
So I think the way I would describe this is a little bit differently in that there's two different types of content on streaming, right? There are the Netflix of the world that have a series that you can stop and buy whatever you want. And we've talked about it on the show before. So will that work? Probably not. You're not going to stop in the middle of the horror scene or the intrigue to buy the shoes the girl is wearing. Or was it maybe on Amazon? Remember, I think it was us too talking about it. So in that way, it's not going to work, right? You're not going to interrupt what you're doing. It'll inspire people. So they do go hand in hand, but that's not different from product placement. But what the Walmart and Home Depots of the world are doing is creating content, a little bit like QVC or live stream shopping, where you're pretending to watch something that is story related, but all in all, it's just about shopping. So that I think will work until the novelty wears off and then people will just be annoyed about it.
Blake.
Yeah, I mean, I see this as sort of just an experimentation ground for the technology that's going to be applied to future use for actual programming. Because, you know, if the content is good and engaging, it's worth experimenting and adding shoppable media in and around it. But what Walmart's doing here is just really content for the sake of making it shoppable, which says to me that this is just, you know, one of the many, many tests that Walmart has been producing over a series of years just to sort of figure out what that mix light might look like that does work.
Paul, I think to Susie's point, interrupting programming like dramas and also sports. So those are probably the two most coveted types of programming on connected TV. That's kind of a non-starter as far as I'm concerned. The Walmart experiment does seem like potentially a new genre. I mean, you know, I can remember when there was no reality TV. So like that came out of nowhere and it just took over. So maybe this is something that catches on, but I think the bar is pretty high. And I think that culturally we don't generally associate like streaming video with shopping directly. And I think that the experiments that have been done so far with any kind of interactive ads on CTV have really not played out to on any kind of scale.
The other thing I would add, which I'm sorry, I know that gives me a red card, but I'm just going to assign myself red cards. You know, we didn't think about, or maybe we didn't talk about it, but we thought about the delivery, right? If you're streaming it on your phone, that process, if it's a one click to cart to your doorstep without really thinking about it at all and interrupting whatever you're doing, much more likely to work than if you're streaming it onto your TV and then it's a clunky experience. So content and experience matters.
Great point. Yeah, we have a high number of shoppable media buyers expected this year. We forecast 100 million, nearly 100 million Americans will be shoppable media buyers this year. What does that mean? Digital consumers who, after engaging with online media content that has immediate purchase options, take actions like clicking through a call to action link or on a live streaming video or scanning a QR code on the TV. This doesn't mean it's frequent behavior, but it's still surprising to see that many Americans doing something like this.
It's also a heavy, heavy percentage of social commerce because a lot of social commerce buyers fall within the shoppable media forecast. Yeah.
There we are. Right.
Which supports Susie's point because that's in a mobile environment. But I think if you're looking at it from Disney's standpoint, you know, their experience is much more centered around the big screen and around sit-down entertainment, whether it's sports or entertainment content. Mm-hmm. So I think in that context, it's just not as viable.
At the halfway mark, Paul is just out in front with 6, Susie and Blake tied behind on 5. Very good game so far, folks. Very high scoring. Round 3, we start with Blake. Brands shifting spending from X/Twitter to alternatives for the Super Bowl in 2024. Reassessing some deals, apparently, writes Trishla Ostwal of Adweek. This year's game, played at the start of 2023, saw a near 70% free fall in Super Bowl ad spending. Apparently, in recent years, the NFL, this is on X on Twitter. In recent years, the NFL Finals has brought in about $35 million in U.S. ad revenue for X/Twitter over the weekend, notes the Wall Street Journal. But Blake, what would this year's Super Bowl look like in light of the X or Twitter controversy?
Yeah, this one's really interesting because there really is no alternative for a platform that gets the type of real-time engagement that Twitter gets during these really high-profile public events. I think, you know, some brands are definitely going to be noticeably absent. You're probably not going to see a ton of big engagements, but the reality is that there will be, you know, an increased level of user activity on the platform during these events, even if the overall, you know, monthly active users continues to fall on Twitter, or sorry, on X. But I think you'll see some more experimentation, particularly on TikTok, maybe even Instagram too, as a way to reach consumers during the game because of the, you know, brand safety issues that a lot of brands are feeling when it comes to X, especially around a high profile event like the Super Bowl, where things can, you know, go wrong at a moment's notice. It seems a little volatile.
Paul?
Well, I see Blake's point about X being particularly conducive to marketers in that environment around the Super Bowl, but I also subscribe to the point of view that my colleague, principal analyst for social media, Jasmine Emberg, makes about X being not a must-have for most marketers. I think what's more to the point, though, is that, you know, the New York Times recently estimated that X lost or will lose about $75 million just in Q4. So then if you add to that the $35 million that this Adweek article expects they might lose around the Super Bowl, that's $110 million all from self-inflicted issues that have nothing to do with the platform. They have to do with a very erratic leader who's creating these problems for himself and for the business.
Susie.
So I actually never thought about X as an advertising haven, to be honest with you. I thought about it more like the central area where people go, the court area where people go and chat. And so to think that the conversation is going to lack is 100% right. Nobody's going to be there to talk and engage. The actual advertising, I can't even figure out where they were spending that much money. I think it leaves a lot of room for unboxing and taste testing and doing driving of the cars and like back end, how did this commercial get shot? Sort of different ways of engaging with the consumer in short video style, whether it's YouTube or Instagram, which will be fun. I think much more fun than listening to people talking about what was your favorite ad, or reading about what was your favorite ad and what was the new Doritos commercial or the Labatt's commercial or whatever it is. So I think it's great.
Miss Ostwald of Adweek expecting less spends, not mass boycotts, saying rather than completely pulling their presence on X, it's more likely brands reduce their media strategy to just organic content or put some dollars into selective ad products like in-stream video to have some control over brand risk. Let's move to round four, folks. And it is...
Before we do that, I just want to say it was very sly of Susie to drop in a Canadian brewer into... her list of examples.
Every week.
Though, frankly, Susie, a little shameless to plug your country that way. I don't know who does that.
I mean.
Tasteless, Susie.
Before
Tasteless.
You know it, I'm going to have a Canadian flag on my Christmas tree.
You should.
I mean, be ready. After Marcus said that his dinner party data was around most visited tourist sites, and I'm pretty sure he's going to ask us what we think, and be ready for mine.
I won't ask
that. Hey, you have to.
Stuart, who runs the team, this video podcast idea was terrible. We have to cancel it immediately. Before Susie decorates her entire apartment. So at three-quarter mark, heading into round four, double points, round four. Paul's just out in front with 8. Susie and Blake with 7. Actually, you know what? No, those answers were really good. Let's bump that up. So Paul's still out ahead with 9. Susie and Blake with 8 apiece. It's been a fantastic game, folks. Only one person can win, though. We move to round four.
I mean, if nobody believed me that you made up the scoring, you just proved it to everybody.
No, I just thought that all of they were all good. So instead of all getting 2, you will get 3. Which makes no difference at all because Paul's still there. Round four, we start with Paul. ChatGPT creator OpenAI will pay news publishing giant Axel Springer for using its content to populate answers in ChatGPT and train its AI tools. Axel Springer is actually our parent company, along with Business Insider, who they own, Politico, and many others. Alexandra Bruhl of The Wall Street Journal thinks that this multi-year licensing deal is a significant milestone as media companies push for compensation for the use of their content in AI tools. But Paul, how big of a deal is this tie-up between OpenAI and parent company of a lot of folks, including us, Axel Springer?
I think it's a very big deal because it creates a new potential revenue stream for all publishers. I mean, obviously, Axel Springer is taking a leap forward and kind of like being the first to do this. I think more deals like this are likely. There are a lot of unexplored aspects of this that I think are going to continue to surface in terms of the content that gets served and ownership of the content. And a lot of the questions that we've been debating around ChatGPT and around AI, generative AI overall. But I think in terms of a business deal and what it sets forth for other publishers, it's pretty significant.
Susie.
I think this is brilliant. It's win-win, right? For ChatGPT, we all talk about garbage in, garbage out. So it brings all this credibility. They're going to have sourcing. They're going to have access. They also apparently have a deal with Reuters. They're going to have access to all this archived information to have smarter answers. So it's going to make their product better. And like Paul said, for the publishers, it's a new revenue stream. And it might even bring new subscribers who constantly see the sourcing and they're like, wait a second, I should probably subscribe to this and get more more information and more news. So I think it's win-win.
And maybe we'll have an ad-free internet after all if everybody starts or goes back to subscribing to news sites.
Totally. And I find they did it very cleverly because it's not exclusive. So they can go and sell their stuff to any other OpenAI style, any kind of technology tool and make even more money. Love it.
Blake.
Well, I think that because of the fact that Axel Springer technically owns the Weekly Listen podcast, including the Dinner Party data section, I'm very worried that the future of human and artificial intelligence might be contingent upon erroneous information that is sometimes divulged during the Dinner Party data segment. So I think that we're all going to have to recognize this immense responsibility that we have going forward and really be careful. Here's looking at you, Susie, about the accuracy of our Dinner Party data so that it doesn't show any credible biases towards, you know, things like Canada being a preferable country.
Armenia,
Poland, being a preferable
Cadbury chocolate. Should I keep going?
And all of the many biases that we may be guilty of on the Dinner Party data section using to one-up each other's and our,
you guys
our
are.
Respective
our respective.
I need a new
finally recognizing this.
I need a new Dinner Party data set.
Oh God.
Darn.
Good answer, Blake.
Well, the thing is, insider intelligence is not part of the deal. So
rest assured
that anything that we publish, which is never biased and always full of fact, is not part of that deal.
Unless it's Susie's dinner party data.
This is the one otherwise insider intelligence is, you know, we obviously take accuracy very, very, very seriously. And I think the one potential hole in the entire organization, perhaps
Susie's
the dinner party data. Yeah.
So first that's, of all, and it my keeps me up at night. Facts are actual. They are real. I'm not making up facts. The whole point is to help educate our colleagues and listeners. And so that is why I'm telling you about places that you've never been to or things you've never thought of. Like the hug. The 10-second hug. Like that
that's
was
too long
my top
to hug
10.
Someone. Yeah. Top 10.
Top
worst.
10 dinner party data. Facts.
For people who didn't listen to that episode, Susie suggested hugging people, all people, for 10 seconds.
With consent. Come on. We had some still, underlying
yes,
rules.
With consent. With consent, it's still weird. You
it's
hug
weird.
Next time you love one who you know is going to enjoy a hug from you, you try and hug them for 10 seconds.
I'm going to count.
Watch them put you in the chokehold.
I'd be very shook if somebody hugged me.
Thank
for
you.
I'd be like, is this the last time we're ever going to see each other? Like, are you like going on a, you know,
what
perilous boat journey?
Uh-huh. Yeah. What have you done wrong that you need
to apologize?
Next time I see Blake,
hugs.
I'm just going to hug him for 10 incredibly awkward seconds.
You bet.
All right, that's it. That's all we've got for the game of the week. Two things for me quick. So it's about compensation, but also traffic. So Susie, you kind of touched on this. Wall Street Journal article explaining that ChatGPT uses information from Axel Springer publications to answer a user's query, and it will include links to the original sources of information below the answer. The new format will generate an answer in the form of a summary, and it will come out in a few months. But the aim here is to ensure that those websites get credit, compensation, and web traffic. If people already have the answer, I'm very, very skeptical that they're going to continue to click on the link. Maybe they will, but I think fewer people will as a result of these chatbots. Other deals to follow. On the one hand, Jeremy Goldman, who writes for our briefing, was pointing out that this comes as the New York Times helped form a coalition to sue AI leaders like Google and OpenAI for using their content in AI model training, concerned about the impact on site traffic and unattributed data use. On the other, the Associated Press already has a deal with OpenAI related to training it. So interesting to see where other folks land on this AI revolution issue, whatever you want to call it. That's what we've got time for the game of the week. Let's check the scores and don't need a drum roll. Paul won! It's Paul Werner, a.k.a. Lionel Messi.
Congratulations,
Paul, to you. 13 to you. Susie and Blake with 12 apiece. A very high-scoring game indeed. You get the championship belt. You can hold on through the holidays and the new year and also the last word.
Okay, well, the last word, first off, I think I tend to only win these things at the end of the year because I won the championship round last year at this time. So very grateful for that. But
I feel bad for you, Paul.
I just want to thank all of our listeners and wish everyone a very peaceful and restful holiday season. And I also want
to
give a special shout out to
Paul. Me.
To you
Not
and to everyone
the
behind
show.
The scenes. I know, Marcus, you always mention the folks who put this show together, but a really special mention to Victoria Grace, who is our audio editor, and Lance John, who's now doing the video part of this podcast. Both of them, by the way, fun facts, they have their last names or first names, which is, I think, a criteria for hiring people here.
Yeah, Stuart, what's that?
And I also want to send a special shout out to Stu Entner, who pulls all of the strings, puppet master, and just a great guy to work with. So thank you all for making this great, but also fun.
Perfect. The perfect.
And thank you, Paul, for ensuring that you win the next 10.
I was just thinking, you've already won. Yeah, what's the point? Come on.
Most of next year. Yeah. Well said, though, Paul. Thank you to all those folks. Danny has helped us with video too. We've got James, who copy edits the show, and Sophie, who does our social media, and everyone who's been on or listens and been a part of it. So huge thank you to everyone for making this a thing still. We really, really appreciate it. And do not take it for granted for 1 second. That's all we've got time for the game of the week. Let's move quickly to dinner party data. It's the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing we've learned this week. We start with Paul, because he's the winner.
Yeah, so this is very timely. The longest it took a song to get to number one on the Billboard Hot 100. Anybody want to guess how many years?
I would say 40 years.
Oh, I've got 42.
And Susie, any
25.
Guesses? Okay, 65 is the answer. Because Brenda Lee's Rocking Around the Christmas Tree, it just beat that record. It shattered that record. It took 65 years. It was released in 19... Geez, I don't even know.
It was right when we won the World Cup. So that would have been...
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, 65 years ago. I can't do the math off the top of my head right now, but the prior record was 25 years between the release of Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You in 1994 and its rise to number one in 2019. So that is remarkable. It goes along the lines of an item, a dinner party data item that my colleague Max Willens had a few weeks ago, which was about the longest it took a company to go from being founded to its IPO. Along the lines of Brenda Lee breaking this record, there are like several other records that she broke, the longest span of number ones, the longest break between number ones, because she had number one records back in like the 50s and the 60s. The fact that she's still with us and is able to celebrate this milestone is even sweeter. So congratulations, Brenda. And amazing achievement.
Remarkable. Very nice way to kick us off. Let's move straight to Susie.
So this is the last week before we all tune out a little bit and start thinking about our New Year's resolutions. There are lots and lots of ways to celebrate the new year. A lot of countries do very different things. In the US, we are really well known for making resolutions. 1 in 3 people usually do that. Oh, and most of the time, people make up 3 resolutions that they're going to try and keep. However, after 3 months, they kind of drop off on average. But I thought maybe you guys don't know where this comes from. So New Year's have been celebrated since the ancient Babylonian times, which is like 4,000 years ago. They started with a 12-day festival called Akitu, which started in March, and they were making pledges to the gods. And they were trying to make sure that the gods would give them favorable crops. And that turned into Julius Caesar, who moved it from March to January 1st, and they were honoring the god, I might say it wrong, I'm not sure, Janus. This does not count as inaccurate facts. These are right facts, just Canadian pronunciation.
Intelligence depends.
The god of the sun, right?
Two-faced god that looked both back and forward. So looked back at what happened in the previous year and looked forward to ensure that they would offer the right sacrifices and made good promises to that god, the Romans, for good behavior. And they believed that if they broke the promises, bad things would happen. And then by the 1600s, it became much more common. And even by the 18th century, it was part of Christianity in some way around reflecting on the past and making resolutions to do better. So do you all know what the number one resolution for 2024 will be? improve fitness.
Have Paul on less. Oh, sorry.
Hey.
I was going to say improve fact-checking.
These are all factual. This comes from Forbes Health. One poll, 1,000 U.S. adults were polled. Number one is improve fitness. One in two people, that is their goal. Last year for 2023, it was around mental health and mental health wellness. So it's moved to physical wellness this year. The most important thing when you're doing your resolutions next week is to think about the tone that you're using, and action resolutions, you will have more chance of keeping them than things to avoid. Like, I'm going to drink less, I'm going to play less video games. You will be less likely to keep those than if you think about, I'm going to try a new hobby, I'm going to travel to new places, more likely to keep those.
Susie.
Yes.
We had this one already.
Stop. Come on. When did you have this one? It's now.
Unbelievable.
Do you really? Did you really? The exact same one?
Yes, it was mine. This was mine last year. So everyone who's loyal listeners will be like, what the hell's going on, Marcus?
Did you have the exact same fact?
Familiar,
yeah, where New Year's resolutions come from. Yeah, January of last year. So I apologize to the listeners for this recycled material.
Apologize to the listeners and to OpenAI. Yeah, OpenAI got back. It was scanning last year's podcast, and it scanned this year's podcast, and it's like, wait, I already got this information. So wait,
but you don't have the top ones. You didn't have the... It was a brand new survey. You couldn't have had this.
That October 23rd. The rest of it was, yeah, was...
Six out of 10... I'm just going to keep giving more facts then.
Six out of 10
feel pressured to set a New Year's resolution. And after fitness, it's finances, 1 in 3. And you can have multiple, as we said, three goals.
We already had this a year ago.
In fairness to Susie, one of her resolutions for next year is to recycle more. Oh. So there you
care
go.
Care about the environment.
Great start.
Thank you, Paul. I can
say
always
good job,
count on
but
you.
We already had that stuff. I can't believe
you did not. Come on. Did you have the whole thing a year ago?
Go back and listen to
No, I have to think forward. I don't look back.
January 31st. January 6th, the week to listen. Is when we had it, but thank
so
you anyway
rude.
For reminding people of my
how important
of my dinner party day from a year ago. Blake, you're up, mate.
So sad.
I'm pretty sure that we've featured some iteration of this data before, but
now you're hedging your bets.
This is really important data, and it's really important to keep a track on. You know, just so we can keep our pulse on what people think, just because it's such an important issue. This is from YouGov, and it asks, is Die Hard a Christmas movie? One of the age-old, highly contested debates. The numbers from this year are in, and they polled U.S. adults in mid-November 2023. 39% of U.S. adults say yes, Die Hard is in fact a Christmas movie. 11% say they're not sure, which is pretty good that like that many people have an opinion on this. Yeah. 50% say no, Die Hard is not a Christmas movie.
What do you think?
I think that 50% of Americans are wrong. Die Hard is absolutely a Christmas movie. And I'll tell you why.
What makes it a Christmas movie?
Because it's nothing short of a Christmas miracle that John McClane can save Nakatomi Plaza from terrorism while at the same time saving his own marriage. I refuse to be told otherwise that Die Hard is not a Christmas movie.
All right, that settles it. I think Blake's got, yeah, it's a good point. All right, fair enough. Let's move to one more for the year, folks. I got one more for you.
I hope it's not recycled.
No, it won't be. I wouldn't dream of it. The most visited tourist attractions in the world.
This is according to Disney World.
Let me set it up. Let me set the table. This is according to a far and wide article. So think about it. Or unless you're Susie, just yell stuff out. Think about it. One guess each. Whoever gets the most visited attraction wins.
Mount Ararat in Armenia.
No. And no, Canada did not make it.
It's not Niagara Falls. I'm sure it's the Eiffel Tower, but I wanted to talk about Armenia today.
Eiffel Tower also is it, no, it's in 36.
Oh,
is Mecca a tourist attraction?
No.
Okay, so then Disney World. It was either going to be one of those two.
Let me just triple check what you said the first time. Yeah, no, it's not. Disney does feature. Yeah, Disney is 8th and 9th on this, and I'm sure most of the other 50 further down. Walt Disney World, Magic Kingdom, Orlando, Florida, $17 million a year. Disneyland Park in Anaheim, I think about $16 million a year, obviously in California. Paul?
So wait, you said the Eiffel Tower is not?
Or it's 36th what rank is? On this list.
No, yeah. You're kidding. Yeah.
Faulty research.
It's not even the most visited. You can guess try and guess the most French tourist attraction.
Oh, Mona Lisa. It's the Mona Lisa, yeah.
It would either be the Louvre or maybe Paris Disney or whatever
it's
called.
The Louvre is 26th. Yeah. Disneyland Paris Versailles. Is 16th. Versailles. The Palace of Versailles is 48th. And the other one, which is actually higher than the Louvre and the Eiffel Tower and Palace of Versailles, Sacré-Cœur, the Roman Catholic Church.
Notre Dame
is number one in
France.
In France.
Right, so the top one in the world, I've completely blown it already. I'm going to guess it's not the obelisk in Buenos Aires, which is what you're seeing in the background there.
I'll give you a clue.
It's the Egyptian pyramids.
Nine of the top 10 are in America.
What?
Yeah, it is the second most visited country in the world. The first most visited, though, is France. So I'm surprised that...
So is it the Grand Canyon?
That is not on here.
It's Las Vegas Strip. It's the Strip in Las Vegas.
You're Googling it. You
I am not. Look
monster.
At my hands
yes,
right
you
here.
Are.
You swear to God I'm not. Swear I'm not.
America.
Like, that makes me so sad.
And everyone else listening, she Googled it.
I didn't Google it.
It's the number one tourist attraction.
Yeah, 40 million
people. Oh my God, that makes me so sad.
Is that just made up of Americans going to the Las Vegas Strip, though? Or does it exclude like people who live in the U.S. who just go there?
All folks, because it's the majority Americans, large majority Americans. But yeah, the top three, the Strip, 40 million, Times Square, 39, Central Park, 38. Yeah, New York will be happy to know that they've got two of the top three. Union Station, D.C., 33, Niagara Falls, 23 million, Grand Central Station, 22, Faneuil Hall. And then the other one, so U.S. is top nine, one through nine. And then the 10th place is the Forbidden City, Beijing, 15 million.
Oh, wow.
It's an imperial palace complex.
Niagara Falls is probably the Canadian side, though. Just saying, it's nicer on the Canadian side.
It said
side.
The U.S. and Canada. I knew you were going to say that, so I checked. Yeah. It's the U.S. and Canada. Okay, combined.
The only reason I knew the Strip is because of the way your face contorted and you were like horrified by what number one was. So it was obvious.
Well, I saw
that's
you
what
typing and reading the screen, and then you said the Strip.
You absolutely saw me doing that.
Horror.
Would
cheater.
Never cheat.
I have to say,
plagiarism.
If I was
going to
cheat,
Susie,
it would be
banned
for
from the game of
the
week.
Retail.
And the week to listen. 1 year, 2 years, 5 year ban. That's all we've got time for this episode. You'll see Susie never. Thank you so much to my guest, though. Thank you to Susie for hanging out for her last episode.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. No, you'll see Susie on the first episode of the Week to Listen in the new year. So she will be back, hopefully. She probably hates me. But thank you so much to Blake as well.
Yeah, happy holidays, everyone. Happy New Year.
He will also be joining us for that episode. And huge thank you to this week's winner of the Game of the Week. And winner in general is Paul Ben.
Thank you all. Happy holidays.
Thank you to Victoria, who edits the show, James, Stewart, and Sophie, who help us out massively with making this podcast a real thing. Thank you to everyone listening so much. To echo what Paul said, we really, really, really appreciate everyone giving even just a few seconds of their lives to this show. It means the world. So thank you to everyone who's listened to it, worked on it, sold it, everything. Thank you guys so much. We hope to see you guys on January 2nd for our next Behind the Numbers Daily episode in 2024, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Affinity Solutions, where we'll talk all about some 2024 trends. Happy weekends, folks, and of course, happy holidays.